Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Plotty in Washington, D.C.
As God may have it, there was no political issue with the bill. Both political party, the opposition and the ruling party, everyone came on board, everyone supported it, and it was passed in Parliament.
Sierra Leone's First Lady expresses excitement over the new law banning child marriage in the country.
The campaign to clean up the payroll, to remove discrepancies in terms of duplicate accounts, fictitious names from the payroll.
The Liberia Civil Service Agency identifies 687 ghost names in the civil service.
And that's why you can see it is very easy for their commander to resign. And immediately he resigns, he does not leave a vacuum. There is a very good transition from him and to anyone else who takes up that office.
And a Kenyan security expert hails the process of replacing the police chief. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sierra Leone's First Lady is excited about the new law banning child marriage in the West African country. Mrs. Fatima Madabew says the prohibition of child marriage law will ensure the protection of girls and stiffly punish those who engage in marrying girls who are under 18 years old. Her remarks come after President Julius Madabew signed the Prohibition of Child Marriage Act into law following an overwhelming support from both the ruling party and the opposition in Parliament to approve the measure. The new law imposes a 15-year jail term or $4,000 fine or both to anybody found guilty of engaging in early child marriage. In an exclusive interview with VOA via a video link, the Sierra Leonean First Lady, who has been campaigning against sexual abuse, she calls Hands Off Our Girls, says the new law is a personal victory for women. Here's part one of the conversation.
We've been campaigning against early marriage all these years. 2024, I had to put everything else on hold and focus on the early marriage bill, which we took to Parliament. As God may have it, there was no political issue with the bill. Both political party, the opposition and the ruling party, everyone came on board, everyone supported it, and it was passed in Parliament. So what the president did on the 2nd of July was actually to ascend on it, because even when it's passed in Parliament, the president have to sign it for it to become law. So that is what he did on the 2nd of July. Now, the reason why other first ladies were there...
I was about to ask you that. I understand the first lady of Burundi, the third first lady of Namibia was there, and the first lady of Quebec. How were you able to mobilize them to join you?
Well, I mean, we have an organization called OFLAD, which is for African First Ladies for Development. And whichever first lady is doing something, we rally around you and we support you. And we have a campaign as First Ladies of Africa. The campaign is called We Are Equal. Now, We Are Equal is practically the same as the Hands Off Our Girls, because everything that We Are Equal is campaigning against is what the Hands Off Our Girls has been campaigning against the last 6 years. So I decided that as a member of the African First Ladies organization, let me also launch We Are Equal campaign. So I thought, okay, we are not just going to launch We Are Equal campaign. We are going to launch We Are Equal campaign with action. And that action, the affirmative action for our own launch in Sierra Leone about the We Are Equal is for the president to sign and ban early marriage. So we don't just launch, we act. So that's the reason why the other first ladies were there, to support the signing of the Prohibition of Early Marriage Bill into an act and law. And at the same time, we officially launched We Are Equal campaign in Sierra Leone.
So, Madam First Lady, take me behind the scene, because your daughter was there when the president signed it. What was the message to the people of Sierra Leone? And what did the president say after you went home, after the fanfare? What was his reaction?
The president has always been a very big supporter of everything that I'm doing, especially when it comes to women's issue, when it comes to empowering women. You know his story. This is a man that was brought up by women. You know, he lost his father when he was only 4 years old. So his mother and his sister has been, you know, his role model. They're the one who had been there for him. They're the one who saw him through education. They're the one that has actually molded him into the military and to up to where he is today. So he understands the struggles of women. And because he understands the struggles of women, he has always support anything that will leverage, anything that will give a woman the space, the space to thrive, the space to grow, anything. And he believes that for a nation to grow and for a nation to be developed, you cannot leave 50% or 52% of your population in the kitchen. You have to utilize everybody. And, you know, so for him, he wants success in his government, and he believes that working with women is the right thing. And with that, you know, he'll be able to change laws in favor of women. He will be able to implement things that will elevate women's life. He will be able to empower women. And, you know, with the GIWI bill that he signed in 2022, is another example. The GIWI bill enabled 30% of every elected and appointed position in Sierra Leone now is held by a woman. We have 30% of women in parliament, 33% of women are now ministers, 33.4% of women, 34.3% of women are now deputy ministers in Sierra Leone, 32% are ambassadors and high commissioners around the world. And then, you know, the list go on. You know, when you come to the private sector, the civil service sector also, it's the same, 33% and above. So he had actually involved as many women as possible into every part of our domestic lives in Sierra Leone, in terms of governance, in terms of everything that will push the country forward. He had made sure that women are there and they have a say, and they don't have a say from the back, but they have a say from the front.
Mrs. Fatima Bada-Bio is Sierra Leone's first lady. She spoke with me via a video link from New York. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. In Malawi, a political party led by Vice President Salos Chilima, who died in a plane crash last month, is withdrawing from the governing Tonse Alliance, led by President Lazarus Chakwera of the Malawi Congress Party, or MCP. Leaders of the United Transformation Movement made the announcement Friday at a news conference at the party's headquarters in the capital, Lilongwe. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
United Transformation Movement spokesperson Felix Njawala says the party believes leaving Malawi's governing Tonse Alliance is what the party's president, the late Vice President Saulos Chilima, would have done if he were alive. Njawala said although Chilima partnered with the Malawi Congress Party, he faced a lot of problems with the alliance, including being arrested, rebuked, and sometimes ignored. Njawala said they have agreed today that they should pull out from the alliance. Njawala said the party would now shift its focus to the 2025 elections. He asked everyone who is wishing for the good of the country, including young people, to help the party fulfill the agenda of Chilima, who he said was making Malawi a better and prosperous nation. He says our friends in Kenya are calling themselves Gen Z. These are people who were born from 1995, and you should also not fear and get tired, but you should take part to support the UTM party, which has carried the vision of Saulos Chilima. Chilima and President Lazarus Chakwera signed a Tonse alliance in 2020 to unseat then President Peter Mutharika of the Democratic Progressive Party after the Malawi court nullified the 2019 elections that Mutharika had won. The UTM party has become the third partner to pull out from the governing alliance, which at one time included nine political parties. Political analyst George Piri is a former lecturer of political science at the University of Livingstonia in northern Malawi.
Looking at how this alliance has been managed or governed, one would likely think that the move that UTM has made now has been made late. They would have moved out of the alliance already while late Dr. Saulos Chilima was still the vice president of this country.
Piri says members of the alliance have long cried foul over the failure of the leadership to call meetings involving partners.
Because they were expecting to be meeting regularly in order to monitor how the alliance government was moving. But it shows that the Malawi Congress Party stole the show for the alliance, and they didn't want these other parties to participate in decision-making for the alliance government.
Piri says the withdrawal of UTM technically means the end of the Tonse alliance, because the agreement for the alliance was signed by leaders of the two parties, UTM and MCP. VOA sought a comment from MCP but has yet to receive a response. UTM Secretary General Patricia Kariati said the members of the party's executive committee are expected to endorse the decision at a meeting on July 19. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Blanta.
In the DRC, the leader of the civil society group called Lucha says fighting between rebels and government troops are continuing in spite of the two-week truce to allow humanitarian assistance. Espoir Ngaluki, who is also an aspiring politician, says government troops accuse the rebels of violating the ceasefire. His remarks come after international humanitarian groups say many more displaced people have not been able to receive assistance. They also express concern that the two-week pause in the conflict might not be enough to meet the needs of those trapped by the violence. Espoir Ngaluki tells me that basic needs have become expensive due to the conflict, which he adds has displaced a lot of people.
Since yesterday in Masisi territory, especially in Bashali Mokoto, they had a fight. They fight Congolese army and M23. And even Congolese army, they said that they are respecting the ceasefire, but those rebellions, they are not respecting the ceasefire. And yeah, this is what happened yesterday.
What are the people saying about this fighting in spite of the promises not to engage in any combat or conflict?
Everyone needs peace, every Congolese, because we have IDP who are living in refugees camp. They are suffering. Many people, even food, they become very expensive, and every Congolese needs peace. But we know that the war have failed. We need peace. We don't need war. Because, you know, especially myself, I was born in this war. And I'm growing up in this war. And the question is, am I obliged to die in this war? Since 3 decades.
If the government is trying to protect the people by trying to repel or stop the rebels from attacking, how can economic activity go on when the fighting is still ongoing?
Yeah, this is the question. Everyone is asking the same question. But all those fronts are failing because there is any plan. We already understand many speech. We need actions. And those actions, they are not there.
In Goma and surrounding areas, has the fighting reduced?
It's reduced. It's only on the last territory like in Lubero. But in Masisi, the fight is continue, except in Rutshuru territory and in Lubero territory. It was the last territory where M23, they were fighting with the government army. But in those 2 weeks, since they started, Congo accepted. I think even Rwanda accepted too. But they didn't accept, they didn't stop everywhere. Because even Masisi, it's concerned.
You have a civil society group and other humanitarian organizations are expressing concern that if this two-week agreement or truce is not extended, a lot of more people are going to be harmed as a result of the ongoing fight between the M23 and the government troops. What are the people telling you on the ground about humanitarian aid to them?
Currently, we do have many camps in Goma, in Iragongo territory, and personally, I think that all those people, all those persons, they need peace, they need to return in their home. But the humanitarian aid, the need of people is higher than what is given to them.
So do you think the two-week truce is not enough? Is that what you are saying?
I don't think that it depends on the time. It depends on the money that will be available to NGOs, even to the Congolese government, because all those who are helping people living in camps or in refugee camps, they are NGOs, international NGOs, and they didn't need time, they need money.
Espoir Ngalukiye is the leader of the civil society group called Lucha. He spoke with me from Goma, DRC. The Director General of Liberia's Civil Service Agency says the organization has uncovered 687 ghost names in the civil service. Josiah Jokai says the government has implemented measures to ensure transparency, accountability, efficiency, and root out corruption. His remarks come after President Joseph Boakai recently launched a program called the Employee Status Regularization Project to be carried out by the Civil Service Agency. Part of the objective, the president says, is a major step towards an efficient, transparent, and accountable bureaucracy. To learn more about the new policy, I read Joseph Joakai. He is the Director General of Liberia's Civil Service Agency.
This is a huge milestone. This supports the efforts of the Civil Service Agency in terms of the campaign to clean up the payroll, to remove discrepancies in terms of double dippers, duplicate accounts, fictitious names from the payroll, because we want to ensure that we have a wage bill that reflects the workforce that we have, and to professionalize the workforce to help improve the efficiency and productivity of the government. So this is a great move by His Excellency Joseph Yuma Boakai Sr., the President of Liberia. And this launch means that the Civil Service Agency has been mandated by the president to carry out this national exercise of cleaning up the payroll.
How will this ensure the enhancement of employment, payroll transparency, and accountability?
Right. This is an effective approach. The whole idea of cleaning up the payroll has a long history. Administrations have attempted to do this, but they have never succeeded in making sure that they have an effective payroll, a transparent payroll, something that reflects the reality in terms of the wage bill. They have not succeeded. Even the president himself said that. And he said that the approach adopted by the Civil Service Agency is pragmatic, and he is confident that we will succeed in cleaning up the payroll and ensuring effective payroll management control and prudence in public finance management, the effective utilization of public resources.
How is this going to work?
The civil service agency, as of today, since the president's mandate on Thursday last week, the civil service agency has set up teams that are going across the country. We have a total of 20 teams, teams comprising of analysts, auditors, compliance specialists, going across the country. We have the regions, four regions, and so we have five teams per region, and those teams are going to cover the entire 103 spending entities across the country. So they are going to carry out a comprehensive and robust employee physical verification and headcounts. That means they will go to each entity, they will do a physical headcount of all the employees, they will request for the credentials of the employees, their national identification cards, they want to request for all the information that they need, they are including their employment letter.
When the president launched this program, he says it is to create a more productive workforce with improved wages for hard-working civil servants. What does this mean?
Right. So all the president was trying to say is that once we are able to remove these discrepancies from the payroll, we'll be able to save millions. And I'm sure the president simply meant that those savings will go towards improving the compensation of employees, civil servants across the government.
I understand some 600 or so ghost names have still been on earth when the president launched this program.
That is correct, Peter. So on that very day, we had an opportunity of sharing the stage with His Excellency the President. And so it was also an important moment for us to make that big announcement. So the civil service agency, using the very app, the system that we have, was able to identify 900 plus unverified individuals, many of whom have duplicate accounts on a payroll. So we immediately went ahead and blocked all of them. And for the period we blocked them, Peter, we interest you to know that only two persons from the 689 who were blocked, only two persons came back to tell us that they were human beings and that they were legitimate employees. We also sent them over to our Employment Services Division to be verified, but the 687 individuals or names, they remain fictitious. So those, I consider them to be ghosts. And as a result of blocking those individuals, the government going forward is going to be saving $2.6 million annually.
Josiah Jokai is the Director General of Liberia's Civil Service Agency. He spoke to me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. In Cameroon, the National Secretary for Political Education and Training of the main opposition Social Democratic Front, or SDF, says the extension of parliament mandate for a year undermines democracy. Even B. Muma also says the move appears to be a calculated ploy to eliminate tough competition facing incumbent President Paul Biya ahead of next year's election. Her remarks come after parliamentarians from the ruling CPDM party passed a law extending their mandate for a year. The move, political observers say, will prevent top opposition leader Maurice Kamto from competing in the presidential poll. The governing Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM, holds 150 seats out of the 180-member parliament. Yvonne B. Muma tells me it is about time for opposition groups and critics of the administration to unite to defeat long-term President Paul Biya in the coming vote.
This is another blow to democracy because democratic principles demand that we respect the electoral calendar and allow for free participation. But it has been like a repetition. This is about the fourth time I'm living a prolongation of parliamentary, the local elections, their mandate. So, you know, it takes the political will of he who holds the yam and the knife, and he always cuts it to his side. But in all sincerity, it is a flaw to the supposedly democratic process because why stop others from participating, or why is it that it's one human being who has the electoral calendar in his hands? It depends on him. And I take it like another trick to maintain the ruling junta in place.
Yvonne, the question a lot of people are asking is, constitutionally, the president, or for that matter, the ruling party, is not wrong by implementing a measure that will extend the mandate of parliamentarians. Since it's constitutionally legal, why are people complaining that this is a blow against democracy in Cameroon?
Our actual president has been there for 43 years, if I'm not mistaken. And he had mentioned that he would like to live like one who brought democracy to Cameroon. What stopped him from respecting the calendar and allowing even those who had erred by boycotting elections to participate in elections? Yes, he has the constitutional right to do that. But there are institutions like the regional councils. How are they going to get elected in all of this? Because if this prolongation does not hold for them, then there is a serious breach of the trust of other political stakeholders. You can't prolong the mandates of the parliament and councils. And we know that to elect the regional councils, it's an electoral college, which means the present councillors, you are prolonging their mandate. Give other parties the opportunity to go have councillors too, who can vote them into the regional councils. Well, we have already raised that objection, because what holds for the other elections should hold true for the other elections. The reasons he gave for the prolongation, finances and all the rest, the country cannot hold too many elections in the same year, are understandable and have been prevailing. But it should not be a law that prevents some people from getting into positions they would have loved to. We participate in politics to get elected and to participate in governance, local governance most especially.
Extending the mandate of parliament for a year effectively will block some other opposition parties from competing. And they are saying that it is the opposition party that is to blame for not seeing this, because this has happened before, where the mandate of parliament has been extended for at least a period of time, and that willfully deciding not to participate in an election is your own doing when parliament is extended. How do you respond to that?
The SDF had been victim of that in 1992, and I think from then we learned our lessons. And no other politician or political party in Cameroon can pretend that they don't master that law that prohibits any party that has been operating in Cameroon as is not represented either in parliament or in any of the councils from participating in presidential elections. They were quite aware of the law and decided to do what they did. So, in all sincerity, these are the consequences of wrong decisions from certain leaders. You can't eat your cake and still have it, and that is what is happening. They boycotted. It's their business. They decided to do so fully aware of the principles in practice.
What do you say to some Cameroonians who say your party could be a beneficiary if one of the major political parties does not run?
In all honesty, Peter, if we all call ourselves opposition parties, this is when we should pull our resources together and get the ruling junta out of place. But for egoistic reasons, some may think that it must be them or nothing.
Yvonne B. Moma is the National Secretary for Political Education and Training for the Opposition Social Democratic Front, or SDF. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. A security expert says the immediate replacement after the resignation of the Inspector General of Police shows Kenyan security institutions are well structured. Richard Tuta also says there appears to be no evidence to prove that Kenyan police officers use excessive force against young people who protested against the recent finance bill. His remarks follow the resignation of Japheth Kony following reports of police brutality during the recent demonstrations. President William Ruto has appointed Deputy Inspector General Douglas Kanja to replace the police chief in an acting role. For more reaction following the situation, I read security expert Richard Tutor.
One thing that has come out clearly is that the Kenyan police is well-structured. It is guided by the rule of law, that it has good succession arrangement in place. And that's why you can see it is very easy for their commander to resign. And immediately he resigns, he does not leave a vacuum. There is a very good transition from him and to anyone else who takes up that office. That one tells us that as a country, the National Police Act is very clear. Our constitution is also very clear as far as the security of this country is concerned.
What do you say to those Gen Z protesters and some Kenyans who said he should have resigned a long time ago after it was proven that some of the police officers who tried to stop the protest or tried to control the protest abused the rights of Kenyan citizens instead of protecting them?
You see, what we have currently, as far as national security is concerned, are just allegations and counter-allegations. And no allegation has been proved against the police or maybe the Inspector General of Police himself. So it is just about matters to do with perceptions for the time being. Because you remember the debate as regards to excessive use of force vis-a-vis the police saying that they use relative force. It's not just something that we can say is a preserve of this country. This is a debate that I can trace it to the ancient time when Jesus entered the church and chased everybody away. If you could have asked the Pharisees by then, they could have said that even Jesus himself used excessive force.
Some have also called for an investigation to the circumstances that led to the death of some individuals as a result of the protest and clashes with the police. They're calling for errant police officers who use excessive force to be prosecuted. They are even faulting the president for not taking the stand. As a security analyst, what are your thoughts?
One thing is that we must be conversant with how our constitution is crafted, and especially Chapter 5 that deals with various aspects of human rights. And remember, there are various other institutions that have been charged with the responsibility to police the police. One of the institutions that has been charged with the responsibility, which everybody is looking upon to, is IPOA. The other institutions that have also been charged with the responsibility to check on the police is the Kenya National Human Rights Commission. We also still have the judiciary, which has got some responsibility to check on the excessive of the police. We also have parliament that has got also responsibility to check on the excessive of the police. But so far, I have not come across any documentation on any pronouncement from all these institutions and substantive evidence to the effect of all the allegations of the police against the civilian and of civilian against the police.
Going forward, where do you see the Kenyan police or security architecture vis-a-vis the ongoing protest or Occupy institutions launched by the Gen Z protesters who are still insisting that the president must leave office?
You know, the debate that we are having as a country today is where does the limitation of freedom end? And where does the right of the state to security start? Remember that our police is still under evolution. Whatever situation occurs, this situation also has contributed greatly to the restructuring of our police, equipping it, and also to come up with a very good mechanism on how it should operate. Remember, ever since Kenyan police have borrowed a lot from the Metropolitan Police. And if you can check on the Metropolitan Police history, ever since Robert Peel came about with the Metropolitan Police Act late in the 1886, you can see the Metropolitan Police have been there for long. Ours, we are still evolving. And if you look at our police comparatively across the region, I can say we are much ahead. I'm not saying we are the best, But I'm saying we can only look at our police, national police service, comparatively as compared to other democracies across Africa.
Richard Tuta is a security expert. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The president of the Uganda Medical Association is expressing concern about declining public funding for the health sector. Dr. Herbert Luswata says if not immediately addressed, many Ugandans may lose their lives due to the lack of emergency health care delivery. Addressing the media, Luswata warned that the decline in public funds and the overdependence on donor funding is not good for adequate health care delivery. His remarks come after official records show that the health care budget has declined from over $1 billion to $784 million. Dr. Herbert Luswata, president of the Uganda Medical Association, tells me that a drop in funding for the health sector also means ambulance services that help transport patients to healthcare facilities during emergencies will be ground to a halt.
There was money which was allocated by Parliament, and it was actually passed in the budget. However, the President sent back the budget to Parliament and directed that some money should be moved and given to a local construction company which is in Uganda. Among the money which was shifted, included money which was meant for ambulance maintenance, and that money was $27 billion. Uganda received a donation of 116 ambulances from Global Fund, JICA, and other partners. However, these ambulances are not operationalized. So the money was meant to get fuel cards, to recruit staff, drivers, and health paramedicals who are supposed to work in these ambulances, the Type B ambulances. And now that the money is not there, it means the ambulances for this year cannot function.
The question some Ugandans are asking is, why don't you directly engage the government through the Minister of Health to address this deep concern?
The money which we are talking about was prepared by the minister, through Ministry of Health. The chairperson of the Health Committee of Parliament presented it to the Budget Committee, and it was appropriated through the channels of Parliament. It was in the budget, well appropriated, discussed, and passed. So the minister had already done her part, but we think when the president was making this kind of reversal, he reversed around 750 billion. And this included money for health sector and other sectors, including education. So this it is not only the health sector, but for us as health, the people in health, we think our area is very critical. The budget, which has always been allocated to health, has always been very low, below what is recommended by the Abuja Declaration, where we are a signatory, and we cannot just look on when we see that the budget allocation to health just keeps on going down and down every year. And our main reason for engaging the media today is to send a message that the government, if they cannot bring back the money which was donated to a local construction company, then they should a supplementary budget should be prepared to ensure that the areas we talked about are operationalized.
What do you think will be the impact of this if the government does not agree to provide a supplementary budget to support the health sector?
Now, if the money is not brought back, it means we shall not have fuel in the ambulances which were donated. We shall not have the driver and the staff who are supposed to be there. Then the ambulances will be packed for a full year, and they will not work. And then if the money for construction of health facilities is not brought on board, it means the work of constructing these health facilities, we have to stop. And some of these health facilities at risk, we call it a ring beam, they will remain there for a full year, which is it is a waste. If we don't provide the $26 billion to buy additional ambulances, it means Ugandans will continue to die because they are not receiving adequate emergency care services. The maternal mortality and neonatal mortality rates in Uganda are relatively high. However, they have been reducing in the past years because of the interventions which are going on. And this is one of the additions which we were welcoming. because mothers would receive timely referrals. So the Ugandans are going to face a very hard time.
Is there a way where the health sector can explore alternative or private funding?
I may not be able to answer that question. I don't know. However, there are areas which were not touched when the money was being shifted, which for us we think may not be as critical as the health sector, because all of us in the health sector, we need health care. There's money which is put on roads because they were prioritized. Part of this money can be shifted back to health. The government has been constructing roads, for very many years, and they usually receive very big budgets. This money which was taken away from this critical area is very little. It can, they can move from other sectors and bring it back.
Dr. Herbert Luswata is president of the Uganda Medical Association. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Protea, in Washington, D.C., coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent.
You're the one I want, oh, before my liver start to fail. You're the one I need, oh, before cassava start to fail. If I ever leave, oh, make what I carry me to go far away. So I am looking for the sister. Jova, my lover, oh. She got the dollar. She the way designer, oh. So I am looking for the sister. Jova, my lover, oh. She got the dollar. She the way designer. She said give me assurance, yeah. Assurance, yeah. I give my baby assurance. I give my baby lifetime insurance.
Exposure. all my guys, them know me. Since 06, I've been writing this story. I know be OG, but if you ask them know me. I know they blow trees, only lonely me low. Music chose me, just know this and know peace. I get lucky, but I'm never lonely. Sexy ladies, come wine feed me slowly.
I love you, I see now you wake me.
I remember.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mark Bill Yarborough and engineer the great Al Santos, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, there are no shortcuts to the top of the palm tree. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.
I know they are bad, stop acting innocent. We ain't got generational wealth, it's only a year that I've had these millions. My whip could have been in a Tokyo drift car, it's fast and furious. I went from the Toyota Yaris to Urus, they had their chance but blew it. Now this gal want me and her...